The hour of 8:30 having arrived, I'm going to call to order State and Local Government Operations Reform, Technology, and Elections. The first bill on the agenda is House File 2866. Representative Carlson. Representative Carlson, I will move House File 2866 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to Finance. And then you had a guest that you wanted to call up right away before we actually
David Schultz, if he's...
He's not here.
He's not here yet.
Then we are not going to call him up. So to the bill.
Yeah, I may interrupt the presentation, if it's all right, Mr. Chairman, when he does arrive. He has a class to teach at 9 o'clock this morning. He has to leave by 9, and so we wanted to accommodate his schedule. Mr. Chairman, House File 2866 deals with unallotment, and by background, just a few points that I would like to make. The unallotment statute was first enacted in 1939, but has not been amended in several decades. It does raise constitutional questions, and this is important legislation as a result about the separation of powers in state government. And Article 3 of the Minnesota Constitution declares no department of government shall exercise the powers properly belonging to either of the other departments. This proposal that has been drawn upon the input of a number of legislators, and using many other states as a guide to restore the balance of power, and that's what the legislation would provide for. Currently, Minnesota has one of the least restrictive unallotment statutes in the country, and this is part of our attempt to bring it in line with other states. And I might point out, when I reference the discussion with other legislators, there were some who were initially proposing a repeal of the current unallotment statute. Others were proposing that we have legislative approval. And I might comment briefly about those schools of thought. The absolute repeal, we were told by our fiscal people, would create some problems with the bond houses. They like the fact that you can, in an emergency situation, adjust the budget. So when we were drafting the legislation, then we rejected that approach for that reason. And then legislative approval, we were told, has some constitutional problems by House and Senate counsel, and that was that we would be interjecting into the administrative branch. So the approval process then was not included in the bill. But we did look at what some other states are doing, and we tried to draft this bill then in a way that would put it in the mainstream, if you will, of what other states do, and recognize those key points. So the bill itself, to walk you through it, it limits unallotment to 2% of the overall budget cumulative during the biennium, and not more than 10% of any single appropriation, also a cumulative during the biennium. And no program under this legislation could be eliminated. Deferrals, school shifts, for example, would be included in these limits. It prohibits modification to program parameters as part of an allotment. The administration can proportionally reduce payments but cannot modify formulas, eligibility standards, or similar statutory criteria. Unallotment is triggered if there is a deficit compared to the most recent fund balance completed at the end of the legislative session. The law now also requires the Commissioner of MMB to prepare a fund balance analysis after each session, and that is informally done already. It would just make it a part of the law. The LCPFP, Planning and Fiscal Policy, replaces the LAC as the group the administration must consult with before reducing the budget reserve or unallotting. And that's important for a couple of reasons. The LAC currently is made up of a majority party, where Planning and Fiscal Policy has both majority and minority membership, and it's a larger group. So we would also have a larger membership as a result of that, and also both caucuses would be represented. It is effective the day following final enactment. It includes language to transition during this biennium that limits on allotment to the current $1.2 billion deficit. So, Mr. Chairman, that would be a quick overview of the bill. And is, I don't know if Mr. Schultz is here.
Rep. Simkowski, I didn't see him come
okay.
in, but we're going to proceed no matter what.
Yeah, I just
this
want to
this class runs
get
on time also.
And, to be on.
And we've got a schedule, so questions?
Well, that ends my presentation then, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Lanning.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Carlson, if this had been in place last year, last session, what would have happened?
Representative Carlson.
He would, if this would have been in place, the governor would have been limited to some degree because he did on a lot be above the 2% level. He also did eliminate some programs, and he also reduced the criteria for some others. So it would have had an impact, although this bill is designed to take place moving forward the day after final enactment. So it's not designed to have any impact on the current court case or decisions that were made prior to this. But if it would have been in place, he was above the 2% level. So that would have kicked in. And then a couple of examples, the hours for personal care, those were adjusted. So under the criteria of the bill that you could not change statutory criteria, that would have been impacted. The renter's credit would have been another one. The political contribution, which was eliminated, because you couldn't reduce any the overall 2%, and then you couldn't reduce any program by more than 10%. So it clearly would have had an impact, and that's the purpose of the legislation.
Representative Lanning.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I understand that, but how would have we balanced the budget?
Representative Carlson.
Probably the governor would have had to do one of two things, I would guess. He would have perhaps called a special session. He would have been able to do some unallotting up to 2%, and it might have, with the 10% requirement, changed how he approached some other accounts. Probably the biggest impact would have been the 2% limit.
Representative Lanning.
Mr. Chairman, we would have been in an impossible situation. We would have not been able to solve the budget deficit. The 2% would not have done the job. And what if the governor would not have called a special session, which he wouldn't have done? Then where would that leave us? Wouldn't we have a constitutional crisis at that point?
Representative Carlson.
We may have a constitutional crisis in a sense. It's before the courts right now, and the lower court has raised that particular question. It's purely speculative as to what would have happened, so I don't know if I could comment any more, but the option that the governor would have had and used historically would have been a special session, conceivably, if he couldn't make the 2%.
Representative Lanning.
An important thing to maybe point out is only once in the state's recent history, at any rate, going back to 1980, the unallotment did reach 2.6%. Another time, in 1986, it was 1.1%. 2003, it was 1%. 2009, it was 0.8%. The last unallotment, it did exceed the 2%. But I wouldn't say we would have a constitutional crisis. Governor Quay, when he was dealing with the issue, called a special session.
Representative Carlson, there's no limitation to the number of times the governor could use this during the biennium. Since we've had fluctuations in the forecast, he could use this once, twice, three times, as long as those percentages were not exceeded?
That's correct.
Okay.
It's an accumulative number, though.
All right. Representative Lang.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Carlson, this is not a fix. This is not a fix. This is not going to enable us to balance a budget, and it's going to take away all the necessary powers that the executive branch has to have in order to keep state government functioning and in order to balance the budget. And furthermore, Representative Carlson, you know, as you folks were passing bills last session without a means to pay for them, did you not anticipate that there was a possibility that unallotment could be used by the governor?
Representative Carlson.
I didn't happen to anticipate that. The governor, if you'll recall, signed every single one of those appropriations bills, and then he chose to veto the revenue to fund them, and he went the unallotment route. Several things could have happened. There could have been negotiations as a result of his vetoing the bill rather than just choosing to go with unallotment.
Representative Lanning.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Carlson, you kept passing bills without a means to pay for them. And if you didn't fully expect that the governor could unallot, you weren't using very good judgment, in my opinion. And that led to this whole situation. Instead, you finally brought us a balanced budget in the last few minutes of the legislative session. There was no time whatsoever to try and work out some kind of deal. So you really, your actions really brought this whole thing about.
Representative Carlson, you wish to... I have others on the list, so I can...
I think I respectfully disagree with the comments that were made. The governor gave no indication that I recall that he was going to unallot.
Representative Gutwell.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. I was going to just leave it with Representative Lanning's comments, but the only thing I would add is we did not see the proper negotiation during session, and this goes to the bill. We did not see the proper discussion during session to figure this out. And with bringing the solution at the last hour, the message was special session, forced tax increases. That's the only way we're going to solve this. We had how many months of session to sit down with the governor and work this out, and that didn't happen. It didn't happen. And you can blame the governor, but there's two sides to this, at least two sides. So, I mean, this, as Representative Lanning pointed out, does not fix the situation. It doesn't get us on a path towards figuring out our systemic and continuing budget deficit that is largely the result of too much commitment to spending and not enough commitment to right-sizing government and living within our means.
Representative Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, you know, we're not attempting to redo what has happened and is before the court. If you look at the effective date, this bill, as I pointed out, is an attempt to move forward. It's effective the day after final enactment, and it does not impact on the discussion that you're bringing up about the last legislative session or what's before the courts. When we talk about the tool that the governor would have, he would still have unallotment authority. There would be limits to it, and that would be the 2% or 10% on any given program. And it would have, if you look at the history of unallotment, as I pointed out, covered virtually every unallotment in state history other than the one in 1980, which was 2.6%, and then the most recent one last spring.
Representative Hornstein.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. I think it's just important to have context here. I mean, the rhetoric's flying about taxes and whatever, but this is about really the responsibility of the executive branch and the legislative branch. And we're going to have Democratic and Republican governors and maybe third-party governors well into the future, and that's what this is about. It's to really define very clearly what the powers of the executive are vis-a-vis the legislature. And so this is, you know, I think it's really important to focus on that piece of the legislation rather than what happened or didn't happen or taxes and spending policies that we disagree with as parties last spring. This is looking prospectively at the role of executive versus legislative. Is that really, isn't that, Representative Carlson, what you're going after here?
Mr. Chairman, in my introductory comments pointed out that one of the things we're attempting to do is bring back, if you will, a better balance between the three branches of government. Yet leave the allotment authority under certain guidelines to the governor, which puts us in the mainstream. We have probably the most wide-open on allotment law in the country. That's what we're attempting to address and move us back into the mainstream.
Representative Biskin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I do appreciate the statements by my friend from Minneapolis. All right, this is about balance, and there are some definite statements here about how government should operate, and I can appreciate that it is a philosophical difference, and it isn't a gotcha, and it isn't a slap. It is what it is. The idea that no program can be eliminated. All right. I understand that that's a philosophical difference and one we should have some honest debate about. But to Representative Hornstein's point, and it specifically deals with subdivision D or section D on lines 2.9, Representative Carlson, where you indeed put in the fixed percentages. I would argue, Representative Carlson, that if we were to put that into law, we do not eliminate a constitutional crisis. In fact, we just shift the constitutional crisis from one debate to another, because we do have a constitutional mandate to balance the budget. We also, in Article 4, Section 12 of the Constitution, reserve the right for calling a special session to the governor himself. However, if we put these strict percentages into law, we now legally try to shift who gets to call a special session. And that's it's unconstitutional in nature. So I think if you're going to have the legislature try and call a special session, then we have to actually change the Constitution and put in a spot where if an allotment becomes necessary, a special session is called. Because right now, this law, as it sits, would force the governor to call a special session, and I believe that's unconstitutional.
Representative Carlson.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, not necessarily. You also have to keep in mind that there, part of this is timing. That you have, for example, there will still be 6 months of the second year of this biennium under a new administration and a new legislative body that would also have the opportunity to make some adjustments if that were necessary. But it would take legislative involvement. So it wouldn't necessarily be a special session, but we'll have an opportunity to talk about that issue on a constitutional amendment tomorrow.
Representative Marquardt.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. And, you know, we can go back to last year and talk about our own version of things, and I disagree with many of the comments I've heard already, but, and I might have my opinions, but it doesn't matter. People want to move forward. The people of this state want us to move forward and get the job done. So what happened last year, and what I appreciate Representative Carlson's comment, is this moving forward? Because I could give you 30 minutes on what I thought happened, and some may disagree. But I want to use a situation that is before us right now. And then I'll ask Representative Carlson a question. Governor Plenty proposed his budget the other day. And in that budget, he has $400 million of the $1.2 billion. He is counting on federal dollars that may not come. Now, when I was the mayor in Dilworth, a city of 3,000, much less a state of 5.2 million, I would have dismissed immediately anyone suggesting dollars in our budget if we couldn't for sure count on those dollars. But we've got a governor here that has done that. So my question is, let's say absolutely the governor would not compromise. And in the end, our budget is as the governor proposed. And the federal government working as efficiently and productive as it has, but let's just say it's somehow something false there and they don't pass this $400 million that is supposed to be coming our way. What would happen? Could the governor unallot? And my feeling is unallotment is in a situation where there's something unexpected. Well, I don't think it would be really unexpected to not get this $400 million. So, Representative Carlson, under your bill, could the governor then, if that $400 million does not come in, could he unallot $400 million based on his proposal?
I'm Sam Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, the number that he could go to would be 680, if that's what you're asking about, and the question would be on the 387.
Right, I presume it.
Oops, so, Mr. Chair,
I presume it'd be 400 million. Let's say everything else would be a 400 million shortfall. How much would he be able to?
He could go under that Carlson. One point, Mr. Chairman, 680. So he would be able to numerically cover it. If I get the gist of your question.
Yes. Okay. Thank you,
right, Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I read at some point here. I thought I saw language that said that statutory formulas may not be changed through unallotment. Is that language in this bill, or is that elsewhere?
No, that
Representative Carlson.
I don't know what that is.
We'll find it here in a second.
Representative Carlson did go over this in his presentation, and I.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Carlson.
C, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Representative Winkler.
And Mr. Chair, I guess I have a question to Representative Biskins and his constitutional theories. And the question is whether the governor, under any circumstances, could, on his own, change state statute without the involvement of the legislature.
Is this directed to Representative Biskins?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Winkler, I don't believe so. I don't believe he can, and so I'm not sure that that section of this legislation is actually necessary. All right.
Well,
Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, that's actually exactly what the prior unallotment did in a number of cases, specifically on the rent credit. The formula for allocating funds under that rent credit is set in statute. It's a law that has been passed by the legislature, signed by a governor, and is in full force and effect. The very simple constitutional and I think social opinion that prevails is that no person is above the law. The statute is what the statute is. As you said, no governor can change that. I agree. I think that this language is a bit unnecessary, but I would leave it in the bill because there is a possibility that the governor could get away with it. But to be very clear, his unallotment changed state statute many, many places. And that is an emergency power that I think is far beyond any kind of constitutional restriction. I think it just bears noting that we have this sheet in our packet from the NCSL about executive authority to cut the enacted budget, table 7.1. It's very informative. And what is not listed here is the state Supreme Court cases around the country in which it has never occurred that a completely unrestricted unallotment statute has been upheld. There have to be limitations, or it is an illegal delegation of legislative power to the executive, and it will be struck down. So I would, if you have time, turn to this, because I think it's very instructive, and it tells us that Minnesota should be in line with every other state constitution in the country.
Representative Winkler, are you finished? Mr. Representative Carlson, I believe that Mr. Schultz is here, and we're going to get you up right now. Because you are supposed to be in class at 9 or leave at 9.
9 o'clock, my students wouldn't be waiting.
Well, if you want to come up quickly, we're already deep into the bill. And we have a list of members who wish to ask questions when you're finished, and they may wish to ask questions of you, since the Constitution has already been discussed. So welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Sure. Great. Thank you very much. My name is David Schultz, and I'm a professor at Hamline University, and among other things I teach is election law and a class in election law and state constitutional law. And I'm here speaking in favor of HF 2866, which would be making some changes in the unallotment authority of the governor. And I don't know how much ground you covered, so I'll be very brief in terms of what I was going to say. And then if there's things I want to expand, I can. In general, what I think is there are several problems currently with the way the unallotment authority is structured. And some of them are constitutional, some of them are statutory. Constitutionally, I find that I would make the argument that one of the problems is that it violates Article, or at least it runs against, maybe not violates, but it runs in conflict with Article 4, Section 23, which is the presentment clause of the Minnesota Constitution. And specifically, what you have a scenario here is a situation where, theoretically, the way the unallotment is set up, we could have a scenario where the legislature decides to fund a program, governor vetoes, goes back, legislature overrides the veto, it becomes law, and then the governor can still use unallotment authority to basically decide to zero out that program, take 10% out of it, do whatever he wants. And so I argue that essentially the way that the current unallotment works, it almost works like a second veto for the governor and therefore violates the presentment clause. In addition, I would argue that there are problems in terms of the unallotment authority perhaps violating the separation of powers clause of the Minnesota Constitution, both in terms of taking away from the legislature powers that it ought to have, which is essentially making budgetary decisions, and more importantly, the way unallotment authority is set up, it gives wide open discretion to the governor regarding how much money he wants to allot, when he wants to allot it, and whether or not to either zero out a program or not zero out it. And so way too much discretion. And so as I would sort of define this as a problem, there are several constitutional problems. But also during the summer, I had two of my law students work with me in terms of trying to put together whatever legislative history we could going back to the 1930s. You know, and again, it's pretty fragmented in terms of what we can put together. But there's a couple of things that we came up with. One, it does not look like the legislature, when they originally adopted this back in the 1930s, that they intended to give the governor, again, this type of wide-open authority. Two, to be able to unallot in terms of significant amounts of money. And three, it looks like that unallotment was geared towards situations to where it was relatively minor shortfalls, and B, to be used in situations when the legislature was unable to act. And so I think there are numerous problems. I can probably answer more questions. But what I like about the suggestions that are in this bill is that it addresses, I think, two of the major problems that we find with the current unallotment statute. One, if I remember correctly in this one, it places an overall limit on unallotments to 2%, I believe. And then I think, second, it puts an unallotment cap of 10% on any one program. And that eliminates, I think, many of the problems. If I were waving my magic wand, I would probably also put something in terms of timing, because I think that there's an issue that unallotting very early in a legislative session is very different than unallotting near the end of a session. And with that, the way the statute's currently constructed, even if we had a very, very small amount of money in terms of what the forecast was, in terms of the budget being out of whack, that gives the governor the authority to be able to unallot. I would also have some kind of minimum trigger before that can work, too. Thank you very much.
All right. Questions to Mr. Schultz? Representative Biskins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Professor Schultz, if the budget is more than 2% out of whack, as you say, all right, and the Constitution requires a balanced budget, how does that become resolved?
Okay, Mr. Chairman, Representative, I think it should be resolved the way the presentment clause dictates, which is that it's essentially a legislative function to be able to handle this matter, and it should be required at that point that the governor reconvene the legislature if the legislature is not in session, or it should be if the legislature is in session, they should be given the opportunity to perform their constitutional duties. I view this essentially as a balance of powers issue, is that the legislature needs to take back and to have for itself its constitutionally enumerated or delegated powers to be able to assume its responsibility over the budget.
Representative Biskin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Mr. Schultz, I concur with the second part, that if the legislature's in session, all right, but what you're suggesting is that we can write statute which would force the governor to call a special session. Is that not unconstitutional, Mr. Schultz?
Representative Chair, that clearly you cannot write a statute that overrides the state constitution, but what you can do is, by placing limits upon when the governor may unallot, that you either have a situation to where he can't unallot in situations which would make it impossible for the legislature to act, or conversely, you have unallotment that's small enough that it does not require, let me rephrase that, you either have the unallotment occur at a time when the legislature is able to convene, or conversely, you create the unallotment in such a way that you give the legislature ample opportunity when it does reconvene to be able to override the governor's unallotment.
Representative Emmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Professor Schultz, you said it doesn't look like, after you did this research with your law students over the summer, that the legislature back in the 30s intended to give this kind of authority to the governor. Do you have, like, some legislative history, documented things that you base that on? Where does that come from?
Okay, Mr. Schultz.
Mr. Representative, Mr. Chair, part of the difficulty, of course, is sort of piecing together the debates, but it looks like from the sort of historically how the unallotment was used up until recently, the circumstances that were suggested in terms of it being used near the end of legislative session or when the legislature was unable to act seem to be consistent with at least how some of the debates, and again, the debates are very, very fragmentary, both in terms of some coverage in the newspapers, which some of my students uncovered, but more importantly, what little debate there is. So I can't point to any one particular clause or one particular statement where legislators stood up and said X, Y, and Z. But if I were going to make the argument in terms of saying the what does it look like based upon sort of historical practice, that's what it seems to be. Additionally, I would want to make an argument that, maybe it's only a law professor can make this type of argument, I don't know, which is along the lines of saying that I would find it inconceivable that the legislature would have constructed a law in such a way that it would have delegated to the governor almost unguided discretion to be able to assume legislative powers and preempt its ability to make the budget. And that's clearly different than a legislative history. That would be a statutory interpretation argument.
Representative Emmer.
Mr. Chair, Professor, those are two completely separate things.
Of course they are.
I find many things around here inconceivable myself. But as for the basis, I guess it's quite a leap to make statements that you can't point to any one thing in the historical record that supports it, but yet you can rely apparently on some newspaper articles and different things along the way to suggest that it's clear that it doesn't look like the legislature intended to give this kind of authority. I'd appreciate it if we're going to make offer testimony like that, if we could see the basis that you've put together so we can make that analysis ourselves. So if there's something that you've got put together that you developed over the summer, I'd love to see it.
Okay. Mr. Schultz.
Mr. Representative Emmer, fair enough statement. I'm not willing to hang my hat on the legislative arguments as much as I'm willing to hang my hat on the constitutional arguments. Right. And on the constitutional ones, I would stick to both the presentment clause argument, which is basically it constitutes a second veto, and two, that there is both a separation of powers and a delegation doctrine problem there.
Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Emmer, if you're looking for legislative history, you may also want to read the brief that the House of Representatives submitted to the district court in the case.
Members, let's go through the chair and not back and forth, please. Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And in fact, there is some significant legislative history in that brief that is pretty well described. And I think the important point is that Governor Stassen at the time, in his State of the State address, requested authority for an unallotment statute in reference to budget troubles that the state had just experienced. And what they had experienced was that towards the end of the fiscal biennium, there had been an unexpected drop in revenue that left the budget out of balance at the end of the biennium. So that was the history and the background for him to request an unallotment authority to deal with that kind of problem. And I would respond to the theory that Representative Biskins has put forward that eliminating an unallotment statute would then force the governor to call a special session, which would therefore be unconstitutional. You might want to remember that the Constitution doesn't contain an unallotment clause. So therefore, already the Constitution anticipates that in the event that we cannot balance the budget or the budget is out of balance at the end, the only way to change it would be for the governor to call a special session. So in fact, the Constitution requires that the governor call a special session if there is not a balanced budget towards the end. That is the only way to resolve it.
Mr. Chair,
Mr. Schultz.
Mr. Chair, Representative, you point to the part in the statutory history that both my students and I would have pointed to, more the statement of Governor Stassen in terms of making the request. And it did seem to me, at least if you were looking at the same passage that I was looking at, that he was looking at unallotment for unanticipated towards the end of a legislative session with, I don't want to say de minimis, but with small amounts, or relatively small amounts of money that he was looking to try to bring the budget back into alignment.
Representative Emmer, is this from Mr. Schultz?
Actually, no. I felt compelled, Mr. Chair, just to respond that I appreciate the education that Representative Winkler offers, and I would suggest that while we have taken a look at that brief that has been supposedly filed for the House of Representatives, we also did a brief that we did our own research. So rather than relying on someone else, we clearly have a difference of opinion, but I appreciate that there are different perspectives on the issue.
All right, Members, if we could focus questions to Mr. Schultz while he's here, because he is got to get back to class. So are there any more questions to Mr. Schultz?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I don't know what the unwritten rule is. Every school has the one. I'm in pretty good shape. I don't have to be all into right. class until 10 after, so I have a few all minutes. I was going to say, every school has the 10 minutes, 15 minutes, whatever rule is. I have no idea what it is, but I'm not starting class yet, so I'm okay right. for a few minutes.
All right. Any more questions? Seeing none. Well, and thank you very much for coming and helping us today.
Sure. I'll stay for just a few minutes in case okay. you need to have me again.
I'm going to return to my my original list. Representative Kiffmeyer was there. She is okay. I thought she'd slipped away.
No.
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just the sniffles of the winter. Certainly, when I look at some of the issues that are here, and I look at the bill as it's written, we have a legislative responsibility, and we have session to do it in. And if we don't do our job in these balance of powers when we have the time to do that, all those 5.5 months, you know, that is our job to do that. And so if we don't get it done, are we faulting someone else when we've delegated that unallotment authority? I think that we shouldn't be doing that. Certainly it is a purview of the legislature. And I don't think that the spending of the money with constant legislative special sessions, such as what Governor Quay went through, served the people either. One of the things I hear from our businesses out there, the greatest chill to their expansion, to the things that they want to do, is government-created uncertainty. And so the best thing for us when we want an expansion of the economy is seeing that. But the first thing is do our job during the legislative session. We have that job. And then don't criticize others when, having failed to do that, the delegation we gave them is used. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
All right. Representative Kale.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Carlson, as you know, the issue that Representative Biskins has raised and your bill tomorrow that I think we're taking up tomorrow, the constitutional amendment to allow legislators to convene a special session, as other states have, has given me a lot to chew on for over a year. And I am not sure, I was not sure coming into today how I would vote on it. The reason why I raise that issue is because I think that Representative Kiffmeyer brought us to there just now. The legislature passed a balanced budget. The governor vetoed portions of that balanced budget. The remedy, unfortunately, available under the Constitution, the only remedy was a special session for the governor's veto. But the legislature did pass a balanced budget. I was, as part of our regular post-session roundups and conversations with city councils, visited one of my smallest cities, Center City. The former mayor, who's now on the council, staunch Republican, made a comment out of the blue that he expected the legislature to file suit immediately, because just because the governor does something makes it legal. We've heard that argument before on the federal level. He said that is absolutely not true. You are the legislature. You are the ones that we elect. And he's made it very clear he did not vote for me, and I did not expect that he voted for me. But he made it very clear that their ability to help their small businesses has been at risk over the years because of the volatility of insisting on raising property taxes rather than having a balanced budget that's straightforward and is passed by the legislature and signed by the governor. This checks and balances issue is addressed in this bill. I believe I'm going to end up voting to place the constitutional amendment on the ballot tomorrow, because we have to restore the checks and balances of the wisdom of our founders. It's out of whack right now. Not because of necessarily our laws, but the way that our laws have been used by people. And I just want to thank you for bringing forward this important discussion. After a lot of thought, I will be voting for this bill, and I will be voting for your constitutional amendment tomorrow for the very issues and questions that were raised by Representative Biskins.
Representative Gowell, you were next on the list.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, the reason I brought up the hypothetical, no, it wasn't even hypothetical, the example from this past session was to prove the point. I don't mind discussing the balance of powers. I think this is a good discussion, the perfect discussion for this committee. But while we're talking about the governor's legitimate authority and the Minnesota Constitution, we have a constitution that says we must have a balanced budget. And when the legislative body chooses to ignore the executive branch in legitimate negotiations through 6 months to try to arrive at a legitimate solution to a budget, passes a tax increase with virtually no debate late in a session, I can understand that some members of our legislative body are frustrated that the tactic didn't work. That's an abuse of power as well. It left a great deal of uncertainty, and I can tell you, Representative Kalin, from serving on a city council, most of the problem with the uncertainty that frustrates cities has to do with the timing of how things are put in place. And that ought to be changed in statute as well, about how we deal with things like LGA and other aids to local governments, the timing of when those things are done. But this is a classic conflict between the legislative branch and the executive branch. The executive branch had an authority that nobody in the legislature probably expected he would use, but he has it. And it literally forces us to think in terms of getting together with the executive branch and negotiating something that can be signed and put into law on time. You know, we keep hearing that we got our work done on time. We didn't. So the governor used a power that is his to balance the budget, which is a constitutional obligation for the state of Minnesota. Now, we can talk about whether we limit that authority, but that has its own, you know, relative pros and cons that we're discussing. But this idea that the governor abused his authority or abused the power given to him, he has a certain level of power. The executive branch does for a means of checks and balances. And we did not get our work done last session. And I'm sorry if you don't like me going back to last session, but that's what prompted this bill, is a frustration over what happened this past session. And what happened was the result of the legislative branch being unwilling and inflexible in dealing with the executive branch, and forgetting that the executive branch has certain legitimate powers that it can use to accomplish the same constitutional goal of balancing the budget. So I think that's an important context to keep in mind as we talk about taking away powers and returning powers and what the founding fathers thought and all that other wonderful talk. Our job during the 6 months that our deliberative representative body has to get the job done that the Constitution requires of us says that we should be sitting down and working out those things in advance in an orderly fashion, not a stonewalling fashion. And that if that doesn't happen, gee, there are some legitimate executive powers that could come into play. Now we know that. And I don't care if it's a Democrat governor, independent governor, Republican governor. The legislature's job is to recognize that and to work within that structure to balance the budget in an orderly fashion and on time in a means that Minnesotans can participate in. That didn't happen last session. Did not happen. So I'm not interested in taking away the executive authority that would actually force us to think in those terms, to actually do our job as a legislature.
Representative Carlson, you had discussed with Mr. Shepard a minor amendment to the bill. At this point, I would have Mr. Shepard describe that amendment, and I'll move that amendment if the committee wishes or if you wish to have that done at this time. So, Mr. Shepard, can you walk us through the amendment Representative Carlson had requested?
Mr. Chair and members, Representative Carlson wanted to ensure that the consultation under the first section of the bill on the fund balance analysis that the executive branch would consult with the chair of the House of Representatives Finance Committee as well as the other listed chairs. And so to accomplish that, I would suggest on page 1, line 12, after the word representatives, insert Finance Committee and. So the sentence would then read, the fund balance analysis must be prepared in consultation with the chairs of the Senate Finance Committee and House of Representatives Finance Committee and Ways and Means Committee and legislative staff designated by the chairs.
Representative Carlson, is that what you wish?
That takes care of the issue. Thank you.
I'll move that amendment. Any discussion to that amendment? Seeing no discussion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. No. Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. To the bill is amended. Representative Carlson, you have anyone else?
I have really no further comments other than to say that much of the discussion has centered on the role of the legislature and the Constitution. And as I indicated in my initial comments, I focused on Article 3 of the Minnesota Constitution, which talks about the separation of powers and that one branch cannot exercise the powers properly belonging to either of the other departments was where much of my concern comes from. I would point out that at one time, when we talk about the history, the statute actually included the word emergency. And we did talk about that when I referenced it in formal discussions with other legislators. And the concern was that that's difficult to define, but that was a bit of the history of the statute, I think, until the 1980s when the word emergency was dropped. But I think that gives you some intent of the original 1939 statute as well. But I'll stop there, Mr. Chairman.
We have one more member, Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. Just one quick question, and I fully concur with my colleagues on this side, but one of the key, I think, aspects of the case now before the Supreme Court has to do with whether this was anticipated or unanticipated in terms of the deficit. Does this bill at all address that part of the legal question?
Representative Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, yes, it does, because as we point out in Section 1, is that where it is? Okay, that's where it's addressed there, and it's after the session would conclude and the Department of Finance does their reconciliation, and then from that point forward, if there were an unanticipated shortfall, the law would kick in. So it wouldn't be based on the forecast, if that's answering your question.
Representative Anderson.
But again, going back to last year, the session had ended. There was a recommendation that the deficit was going to be there, so that in that case then would make it okay to do what he did.
Representative Carlson.
Yeah, It's the deficit after the fund balance is completed.
All right. Seeing no more discussion, I'll renew my motion that House File 2866 as amended be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Finance Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay?
No.
Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. I'll see you in the morning.
House File 2758, Representative Lilly. Representative Lilly.
Oh, God.
Have you been dumpster diving again?
Mr. Chair, how much time has been allotted?
Representative Gutwell, that's not a prop. That might be an appropriate tool depending on how this bill goes. Representative Lilly, I'm going to move that House File 2758 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Finance Committee. And this is the bill that contains the labor agreements and compensation plans. So I see Mr. Hubinger's here. I'm just going to ask the same question we ask every year. Do we have all of the compensation plans and contracts, or are there any left that we would have to bring back before this committee?
Yeah. Mr. Chair and members, I'm Greg Hubinger with the LCC Subcommittee on Employee Relations. There was one contract for the current biennium that was actually approved by the last legislature in 2009. This bill contains all of the remaining contracts and plans.
Okay. So, Representative Lilly, to your bill, and what's it do?
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members, and I think we'll be a little shorter than the last bill. Boy, that was fascinating, though. House File 2758 is, as you mentioned, ratifies the labor contracts and compensation plans for the executive branch that have been going on while we were not in session. So the Subcommittee on Employee Relations, which I'm chair of, and Representative Lanning here this morning as a member, and we have some other House members and senators, and we meet during the interim and ratify the contracts. I don't know how much detail you want. There's quite a few different contracts. I mean, there's about 50,000 employees that are affected by this these agreements. Mr. Hubinger could go through every one of them. To be clear, you might want to take a look in your packets. Is probably the presentation from Mr. Hubinger, and on the back, I always like to look at the bar graphs, and I think some folks on the Republican side or might enjoy the graph on the back page and the impact to wages. It's just to be clear, these are negotiated between the governor, and if I was negotiating them, they probably wouldn't have a bar graph like this. So, but I think I'll pass to Mr. Hubinger.
Good idea.
Thank you.
Mr. Hubinger, welcome to the committee. You've already identified yourself, but go ahead.
Mr. Chair and member, as Representative Lilly indicated, this legislation ratifies 11 contracts and 4 compensation plans and then 3 amendments to those compensation plans that were given interim approval by the subcommittee in the last several months. As an overview, these contracts, unlike others, do not provide any across-the-board increases to state employees. Employees who are not at the top of their salary ranges will receive a step or performance-based increase in the second year if they receive a satisfactory performance review. About half of state employees are eligible for those increases. Those increases vary by contract, and they range from 2.7% to about 4%. Faculty at Minsky do not receive any across-the-board increases at all. Faculty who achieve additional educational degrees are eligible to be promoted to the next level and would receive an increase as a result of that. Minnesota Management and Budget calculates the cost of these contracts. They estimate that the impact of all these contracts will be about 0.57% on this biennium and will have an impact of about 1.7% on the next biennium. As Representative Lilly indicated, there is a graph at the end of our summary that shows how this set of contracts compares to contracts that have been negotiated over the last 8 years. I'd be happy to answer any questions that are, that you'd have.
Any discussion? Representative Kahn.
Mr. Chairman and members, I know we don't like to amend contracts by legislation, but that was done once, actually, when the contracts had negotiated, certain contracts had negotiated domestic partner health benefits, and then that was changed, I think, in the next legislative session. I wouldn't want to add, I imagine you would not want me to add domestic partner health benefits to your bill at this point, but I wondered if it might be appropriate at some point just not to do contracts by legislation, but just to allow the contracts to be able to make that negotiation should they so choose.
Representative Lilly.
Hi. Mr. Chair and Representative Kahn, I'm not really quite certain how to answer that question. although I support your efforts, I'm not sure this is the means to do it, I guess.
The tool you brought might help you now. All right, I don't think there's a direct answer, so we'll go to Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a question, and maybe hopefully Mr. Hubinger can answer this. I'm surely Mr. Representative Lilly can as well. The AFSCME Unit 8 Correctional Guards, I'm looking at page 7 of the memo of February 11th, had that and the State Residential Schools Education Association had the correctional guards had by significantly larger salary increase than anybody else, and I know that corrections was the only state agency that actually received a increase in their appropriation in the last budget, and I wonder if you have any history or knowledge or justification for such a significant increase for that particular unit.
Mr. Hubinger.
Mr. Chair and Representative Winkler, the pattern of the settlements was the same across all of the AFSCME and the other contracts in terms of providing for no across-the-board increases and only awarding performance increases or step increases. So the difference in the cost would likely be attributable to the fact that there are fewer guards at the top of the salary ranges, so that there more of them are eligible for those step increases, which would increase the cost for that contract.
Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That makes sense to me. Sort of.
Further discussion? Seeing no further discussion, I don't believe there's anyone. Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Lilly, are we on the bill as presented right now? I didn't want to interfere with Mr. Hubinger's presentation. Just to clarify.
Representative Kiff, yes, we are.
Okay.
Yes.
I look at this, and I know that negotiations occur, but last year when we were in the legislative session, we had contracts that had some good increases in it, but they were done the year before when maybe we didn't know about some of these economic situations coming about. But these were done last year, and we know. Mm-hmm. And so I look at this overall increase of 1.69% when I think of people in my district who have taken wage cuts, and they will look at this and say, what are you doing here? You knew these circumstances, and yet you agreed to these kinds of increases. And also, when we had the discussion on the pensions, these kinds of increases also have an effect on our state retirement systems as well, because these will have an effect on deepening the actuarial imbalance there as well. And so, after knowing the financial economic situation we're in, yet these have been negotiated, and my district will not be happy to see this kind of number. Can you explain a little bit more as to why this occurred?
Representative Lilly.
Mr. Chair and Representative Kiffmeyer, just to be clear, these contracts are negotiated with the governor's staff, who's of your party. Mm-hmm. And the staff negotiates and comes up with these agreements. And I think if you look at the bar graph, like I mentioned in my opening statement, with the taking in the a perspective of the future and the current situation, I think it reflects that there is an adjustment to perhaps where we're at reality. And I would argue that you could probably take it back and argue that there's been some clear changes in the impact to the state budget for the future. And this, and to the respect to the workers, I think that they've accepted that there is a change situation, and that they've you know, both sides have negotiated and accepted the, you know, the current reality of our economic situation. So I think hats off to both sides, really, to the workers and to the negotiators, to come up with an adjustment.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One thing I heard more about last year than I think nearly anything in terms of these salaries was bonuses for administration at the state colleges. And I see in Subdivision 9 they're still there, up to 30%. When will those existing contracts run out or change those bonus-type arrangements?
Representative Lilly.
Mr. Chair and Representative, certainly you probably saw the same things on the news that I saw, and that is accurate. That is a pre-existing condition, and as if you read, and it has been stopped. So the chancellor has decided that going forward, that these things will not, that they will not be entitled. It was a, you know, it's something that happened in the past, and it's it will not be going forward. So at this point.
Is that right? Or no, it is not right.
Mr. Hubinger.
Mr. Hubinger, I stand corrected, perhaps.
Mr. Chair and Representative Anderson, there's a provision in law that provides for MNSCU to be able to provide additional remuneration to their chancellor and presidents and vice chancellors. And under that law, MNSCU has negotiated contracts with those administrators that provide for up to 30% of their salary to be provided in additional remuneration. The majority of that is in housing allowance. A smaller amount has been provided in the form of performance pay for achieving performance standards that are negotiated in their individual contracts.
Mr. Hubinger, is that at the discretion of the trustees? They don't have to award that, do they?
Mr. Chair and members, those are contracts that are negotiated with each of those individuals and approved by the board, so the board could choose not to negotiate that particular provision.
And I believe this goes to Representative Lilly's point that these people are appointed in that position and they have an option to do it. It is interesting that the trustees decided to award those given the fiscal situation that was before us and the state of higher education and tuition and student debt. Representative Gutwell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To Representative Lilly and to all the negotiating entities, actually, I appreciate many of the concessions here, and the bar graph is duly noted. When you mentioned reality, I think the economic reality, when you're looking at 3 or 4% increases, granted that's a lot less than what we've seen in the past, but we have to remember, too, that the cost for these settled contracts, if this bill goes forward, falls on the backs of people who are dealing with other realities, which include zero increases and loss of jobs as well. So just to keep that in perspective to a certain extent, that the realities that some other people in our economy are facing are much more difficult than the ones represented in these settlements.
Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd just like to add to your comment about the MNSCU trustees and point out that the chair of that board is David Olson, who happens to also be the executive director of the State Chamber of Commerce. I had an opportunity to write a letter to him last summer inquiring about these particular bonuses. And his answer, and I specifically asked if there are objective numeric standards that have to be met in order to receive the bonuses. And the answer that he gave me to my letter was extremely vague on that topic. So my suggestion is that, in fact, it's an entirely discretionary matter. And if you have concerns, they're the people to go talk to.
Representative Winkler, I made the same inquiry, and I did get from our local presidents the criteria, which I will not list publicly. But if that's the criteria for some of these bonuses, it is an embarrassment, considering the fiscal situation we're in. Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I wanted to just address again what I had brought up before. And I think the main approach, Representative Lilly, for me, was not going back and looking at the fat years and saying, aren't we doing better now because we're only doing a 1.69? It was a comparison to the private sector, which is an average decrease of minus 5%. And so if you compare this 1.69 with the minus 5, that is what the reality of people in my district take a look at, and that's how they look at the government employees and these labor contracts. So I appreciate that they may have done better than previous years, but I don't think that means, ergo, that's good news to the people who have gone down minus 5%. So that was the contrast of what I was making, not to previous government employees and those kinds of years. So I just wanted to kind of clarify that.
Representative Lilly.
Mr. Chair and Representative Kiffmeyer, I certainly appreciate your opinion and perspective. I work for a major company and when I'm not in at the legislature, and quite honestly, my entire work group took a pay cut, and we're happy to have a job as well, though. So I appreciate what you're saying. I think these were negotiated in good faith, and it's a good compromise. But I certainly appreciate your thoughts and understand them.
Representative Kale.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I think to Representative Lilly's point as well, that lest we think that the workers within these bargaining units are having any rosier or easier of a time at their kitchen tables as a result of the budget cuts this biennium. I believe the current number is 3,400 total job cuts there. And I heard a member reference 3 or 4% increases in salary. The total is 1.7%. And one of the things as a fiscal realist and pragmatist that I think we all need to think about is, for instance, in the bargaining unit that Representative Winkler pointed out, the correctional officers. The facility in my district in Rush City has had many vacant positions because of budget pressures to make sure that there's adequate staff to prevent major injury to to correction officers. They've had to pay overtime that costs us all more. So we have to think very clearly and very carefully about painting a broad brush and recognizing the reality of the situation on the ground in all of our state facilities, in corrections and otherwise. So I want to thank Mr. Hubinger and especially Representative Lilly for your work on these contracts and bringing forward this bill to make sure that we can keep our public services functioning at an adequate level.
All right. Further discussion? Seeing no further discussion, I'll renew my motion that House File 2758 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Finance Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. Thank you,
Mr. Chair and members.
Representative Simon. Members, this was a bill that was laid over yesterday, and I believe we have the proper amendment at this time. So, Representative Simon, why don't you renew your motion, and let's bring the bill back up, and then let's...
Thank you.
Get the amendment before us and discuss what we're going to do.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You'd like me to renew my motion that Senate File 80 be recommended to pass and sent to the General Register.
And it was already, so it says amended, and amend it again.
Yep.
But
yep.
All right.
And, Mr. Chair, as you alluded to, we've got the A2 amendment here. Members, if you remember, at the end of yesterday, Representative Winkler brought up a point about the effective date, and we decided because he had a point to lay the bill over, and now Mr. Gehring, in consultation with Mr. Goldsmith, have come up with what they believe is the proper solution. I agree. The A2 amendment only would basically say that the bill, except for the one section, would be effective the date after enactment. The portion of the bill that pertains to the judicial contributions would have a language before you which basically says that it is effective the day following enactment. However, if a judge or judicial candidate has received a certain amount, they can't double dip. In essence, they can't go beyond what we've enacted here today. So
the discussion before us is the A2 amendment. Yesterday I asked Mr. Goldsmith, and you responded properly about there was some confusion about what we were doing. So could you tell us, does this amendment work? Can you implement it? And is it in proper form?
Mr. Chair, members, yes, I believe it does work. We can implement it. I did work with Mr. Gehring. This was not the first version of the amendment that was written yesterday. I think it's the second or third version, and I believe it is in proper form. With respect to judicial contribution limits, the rule would go into effect on the day following enactment. But the further language makes it clear that when we look at contributions after that day, we look at all of the contributions from January 1st when determining if there's a violation. So a violation prior to the day of enactment would not be a violation, but right. After that it would.
To be clear, Representative Simon moves the A2 amendment. So that motion is the motion before us to the bill. And Representative Gutwalt.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to speak in favor of the A2 amendment. It was, I think, wise of the chair to ask us to kind of sit down and think this through a little bit more than try to do it on the fly, if you will. And I think we worked out something that is both workable and fair. And so I would support the A2.
Right. Further discussion to the A2 amendment. And members, this is, again, why it was a good idea probably to do this, but it was also a good idea to wait and do it correctly so that when it is implemented, we're not going to be fixing this in the next legislative session or an attempt to fix it on the floor where we do not have Mr. Goldsmith to answer a question about whether or not it works. So A2 amendment. Further discussion. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. So, Representative Simon, to your bill as amended.
Yes, Mr. Chair. We had the discussion yesterday, so I'll just renew my motion that Senate File 80 be recommended to pass. Senate File 80 as amended be recommended to pass and referred to the General Register.
All right. Further discussion. Seeing none. All those in favor? Signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Thank you. Mr. Goldsmith, thank you, too, for working.
That's
good. Representative Poppy.
I'd like to move the minutes of Tuesday, February 16th.
Representative Poppy moves the minutes. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Meeting is adjourned.